after the lone assassin of Robert F. Kennedy. Again, many people say, well, how could there be anything else going on? How could there be any possibility of anything else going on in that case? Well, if you will stick with us tonight for the next few hours, we have a lot of information to share with you that suggests, in fact, that there is a great deal more to be known about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. And if you're anything like I was when I first got introduced to this material, you're going to not only be interested and perhaps fascinated to know about this stuff, but you're going to be downright angry by the time that we finish tonight when you hear the way in which some of these investigations were dealt with, specifically the destruction of evidence, the outright ignoring, I almost said ignorance, I suppose that might be appropriate too, the ignoring of witnesses with contrary testimony, the, in many cases, intimidation of witnesses, just the entire lexicon of bad faith police work on the part of the Los Angeles Police Department, and in fact, in many cases, what seems to be actual obstruction of justice. Anyway, not to give the whole ball of wax away too early, but that, in fact, is what is going on. Okay, well, as I mentioned before, I've been talking a lot here, but Dave Emery is in the studio with me, and Dave and I are going to be here until 11 o'clock. We will be taking phone calls at some later point in the broadcast if we have time, time permitting. We're never sure about these things. And when that case comes, we're going to be letting you know. We'll give you the phone number, and we'll let you know, in fact, what time to call and when to call.
All righty. Well, I've been administering to our studio here, getting ready to begin the recording process, and so I have not been on mic so far, but Nip/Tuck said about all I think that needs to be said by way of preliminaries. The only thing that I would remind perhaps people of you, those of you in the listening audience who are new to these programs, these Radio Free America programs, the broadcast you're listening to right now is an archive show. We're going to be reading to you for the better part of 4 hours, so these programs are essentially put together in order to be taped. We hand you a piece of the documentary record so that you can examine it for yourself. So if you're a really good listener, perhaps you don't need to, but we would encourage you to tape the programs because that's why we use this format that we're using. We take a large portion of the documentation and read it to you, not expecting you to be able to recall it from memory, but hopefully you'll tape it off the air, and then you'll have a record of the information for your future use. And a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are so very different than what people are accustomed to thinking about that we recommend that people stick to the documentation on this kind of material. So if you haven't already, do begin taping the show off the air.
Okay, and also we should just mention that by the end of the broadcast tonight, if you're interested, of course, we have been doing these. This is our ninth Radio Free America broadcast. If you're interested in acquiring copies of tapes of ones we've already done that you might have missed or that you'd be interested to hear on a variety of subjects and some other specials that we've done here at KFJC, just give us a call and we will let you know how to do it. There's a way to do it at cost where nobody makes any money, but essentially just you pay for the cost of having your tapes copied. So we'll talk about that a little later. Now, one last prefacing statement that I want to make. Quite a bit of the information that we're using tonight, a large percentage of it, comes from an excellent book that anybody who's interested in this stuff and doesn't go out and track down a copy somewhere at a library, at a library sale, at a bookstore, is really missing something because it is a fascinating, terrifying, and enraging book. The book is called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Okay, and the authors are William Turner and John Christian. John Christian is spelled J-O-N-N, and then Christian, just like it sounds, for those of you who view early morning religious television, you know how to spell it. William Turner and John Christian, it's a Random House hardback, and it's copyright 1978. Okay? And I know for a fact that it's available in a lot of public libraries. If you don't have any money, that's no excuse. Anyway, we're going to be using this book for quite a bit of information tonight. One of the things that makes the book so valuable and so interesting is that it is not merely a book of reportage in the normal sense, but it's in fact a book written by people who became angry and upset enough about it to go out and try and find some things and actually do some investigative reporting in the finest sense of the word without losing their reporter's objectivity in terms of marshaling facts and dealing with arguments. So, again, a strongly recommended book, and you'll hear tonight just some of the highlights as we skip through.
And again, not to whip a dead horse, but this is a rare book, very tough book to find. Researchers have a tough time locating it. So in order to preserve at least part of the record, again, these programs are put together so that you can tape them. So please do record this via Oxide if you can.
That's right. Then, because even if you get a copy of the book and you have Turner and Christian, you still won't have Emery and Tuck, right? Right. Okay. We're going to start off with a prologue, which basically goes back and expands on some of the information that I started the broadcast with. And once again, this large part of the reading tonight is from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by John Christian and William Turner. California was make or break for Senator Robert F. Kennedy in his quest for the 1968 Democratic presidential nomination. On May 28th, he lost the Oregon primary to Senator Eugene McCarthy, and a setback the following week in the nation's most populous state would probably ruin his chances. On the other hand, a victory would gain him 174 delegate votes and much-needed momentum for the showdown at the National Convention in Chicago. It would virtually eliminate McCarthy, leaving only Hubert H. Humphrey in his way. A symbol of the old politics, with the albatross of Lyndon Johnson's escalated war in Vietnam hanging from his neck, the vice president was not a good bet to withstand the tides of renewal surging through the party. Most observers thought that RFK would ride the tide past Humphrey and defeat the Republicans' likely candidate, Richard M. Nixon. Kennedy came to California for a homestretch drive so frenetic that on election eve he was on the brink of collapse. He had to cancel a San Diego appearance that night, but the next morning he was back on his feet, buoyed by a just-completed poll showing him safely ahead of McCarthy. After a day of last-minute campaigning, he went to the Malibu home of movie director John Frankenheimer for a quiet supper party that included Roman Polanski and his ill-fated wife Sharon Tate. After supper, Frankenheimer drove him to the Ambassador Hotel, where he would watch the election returns on television in the royal suite.
Interrupting very briefly, remember Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate and their role in the Robert Kennedy campaign in the Los Angeles area. We're going to touch back on that later in the program.
By midnight, he was ready to claim victory. He checked himself in a full-length mirror before leading his entourage down a service elevator to the embassy room on the ground floor. The ballroom was jammed with campaign workers and supporters, and a thunderous cheer went up as the candidate came into view. Speaking into a bundle of microphones on the small stage, he gave a brief speech. Quote, "Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we have been here too long already," he cracked, drawing laughs from the audience. Then, in parentheses, it says, Sam Yorty was a right-wing Democrat who had supported Nixon against RFK's brother in the 1960 election. As a matter of fact, Sam Yorty was the mayor of Los Angeles, and as you will see later on in the broadcast, he is quite a key player in this. RFK wound up by flashing the V sign and exhorting, "On to Chicago. Let's win there." Kennedy intended to meet with the press in their headquarters in the adjacent Colonial Room. Ordinarily, he would have crossed the ballroom floor and exited through the main door, but the crush of people was so great that a last-minute decision was made to route him through a service pantry. A maitre d' gripped his right wrist tightly and led him through the gold curtain behind the stage and into the pantry. His progress was slow as he greeted admiring kitchen workers. Suddenly, a gunman sprang at him, snarling, "Kennedy, you son of a bitch!" He fired two rapid shots. Kennedy reeled backwards, flinging his right arm in front of his face for protection. People grabbed for the gunman. Kennedy landed on his back, his arms splayed outward, as in a crucifixion, a halo of blood widening around his head. Within inches of his right hand was a clip-on bow tie he had apparently snatched from someone close by as he sagged from the impact of three bullets in his body and head.
Remember the clip-on tie, too. We'll touch back on that as well. Continuing here with Christian and Turner's narrative. Up in San Francisco, we, the authors of this book, were stunned by the news. William Turner had run for the U.S. Congress in the same Democratic primary with John Christian as his campaign manager. As the chief plank in our platform, we had advocated the establishment of a joint Senate-House committee to reinvestigate the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Now, the final line of our campaign brochure seemed horrifyingly prescient. To do less not only is indecent, but might cost us the life of a future president of John Kennedy's instincts. Unquote. Robert Kennedy died slightly more than a day later. When the plane carrying his body to New York landed at Kennedy International Airport, NBC television correspondent Sander Van Oker, who had covered the RFK campaign, came down the ramp to face his own network's cameras. Forcing back tears, he reported that during the flight, Edward Kennedy had remonstrated bitterly about the faceless men, unquote, who had been charged with the slayings of his brothers and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. First Lee Harvey Oswald, then James Earl Ray, and now Sirhan Sirhan. Always faceless men with no apparent motive. There has to be more to it, Ted Kennedy had told Van Oker. But Ted Kennedy's words, uttered in a private moment and never to be repeated by him in public, were lost in the rush as the campaign instantly went into reverse. What had begun as a great national groundswell of revulsion against the war, so strong that it swept an incumbent president out of the running, became a nightmare of reaction and irrelevancy. There were pious outcries in Congress for tougher gun laws, breastbeating in the media about how America's violent society had spawned another deranged assassin, and demands for a law and order crackdown. It was almost anticlimactic when Hubert Humphrey finagled the Democratic nomination at the violence-racked convention and tried to pull the shattered party together. He was no match for Richard Nixon, who cynically called himself the Peace with Honor candidate and boasted of a secret plan, unquote, for ending the conflict, which would then drag on for another four more years. So the nation had another accidental president, unquote, catapulted to power by a lone nut assassin. The conclusion that Saran Saran had acted alone and unaided was duly arrived at by the Los Angeles Police Department, which had primary investigative jurisdiction. The FBI, which conducted a parallel inquiry under the civil rights laws, concurred. And most of the American people accepted the theory, since the case seemed as open and shut as the shooting of Oswald by Jack Ruby in front of millions of television viewers. Well, the LAPD will be one of the major focuses of our broadcast this evening, and just how they went about arriving at this conclusion is something we're going to talk about at great length.
Okay, now, it's not going to take a great deal of knowledge of forensics or legal science to understand most of the things we're going to be talking about tonight. This is basically, we've set the stage now, we're going to start talking about, well, not just Turner and Christian, but largely Turner and Christian's findings and some other people's findings as we begin to go over the evidence and the conflicting evidence specifically to the Sirhan Sirhan as the lone assassin without aid, without conspiratorial backup of any kind. Okay, continuing, reading a little further on from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Eyewitnesses uniformly recounted that Sirhan accosted Kennedy from the front and never got closer than 2 to 3 feet from the senator before he was grabbed and wrestled to the floor. And I should just say parenthetically that 2 to 3 feet was the closest estimate. Most of the estimates were actually 4 to 7 feet.
Some as far away as 11, by the way. So 2 to 3, again, as Niptuck appropriately said, that was the closest. Most 4 to 7, some as far away as 11.
Yet County Coroner Dr. Thomas T. Noguchi, who performed the autopsy, declared that all three of the bullets striking Kennedy entered from the rear in a flight path from down to up, right to left. Moreover, powder burns around the entry wound indicated that the fatal bullet was fired at less than 1 inch from the head and no more than 2 to 3 inches behind the right ear. Okay, let me just go over this really quickly because this is, of course, one of the keynote pieces of evidence in the entire case. Okay, the presumption of Sirhan Sirhan as the assassin is that Sirhan Sirhan, as all the eyewitnesses recounted, came up to Kennedy from the front, fired on him from the front, at least 2 shots, and then was grabbed by several people and continued to fire as he was pulled down. Okay, so we have a face-to-face, front-to-front shooting. But now the county coroner, noting stapling or powder burns on the wound, concludes that the wounds, especially the fatal wound, were within inches, and especially one of them within an inch. Okay, when none of the witnesses said that Sirhan was any closer than several feet, which will not produce those kind of powder burns, and that in fact the wounds were from the rear, when, as we said before, Kennedy was shot from the front, he covered his face as he fell, everybody saw him being shot from the front. Okay, going on. Thus, it would have been physically impossible for Sirhan to have fired the shots that struck Kennedy, even allowing for the remote possibility that Kennedy twisted completely around, which is contrary to witnesses' accounts, that he threw his arms in front of his face in a protective reaction and sagged backwards. There remained the point-blank shot. Noguchi later revealed that before he entered the grand jury room, he was approached by an unnamed deputy DA who solicited him to revise the distance, quote, from 1 to 3 inches, which is Noguchi's estimate, to 1 to 3 feet. The coroner bravely refused to cooperate, quote-unquote, with this blatant attempt to suborn perjury.
So again, recall that the coroner's inquest, the autopsy results, concluded that the fatal shot had been fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Kennedy's head, from the bullets traveled from down to up and from right to left. And again, restating this, because many people who were listening were not alive at the time of the Robert Kennedy assassination or were too young to have really paid much attention to the event, that, again, Sirhan Sirhan accosts Kennedy in a very crowded pantry, fires or allegedly fires shots at him from a distance of anywhere from 2 to 11 feet in front of Kennedy, according to the various eyewitnesses. Fatal shot fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of his head, and notice here already an attempted cover-up when a deputy DA attempted to solicit incorrect testimony from Coroner Noguchi. Incidentally, people who would like to seek contemporary corroboration of this autopsy result, Noguchi is author of a book which is currently out in softcover called Coroner, which doesn't go into the Robert Kennedy case in terms of the criminal aspects of it in any great detail, but it does recount and repeat Noguchi's finding that the fatal shot was fired from, a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Senator Robert Kennedy's head. Continuing with the account here. Again, from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian. Although the DA and LAPD continued to insist that only assassination freaks were raising questions about the shooting, Baxter Ward is an LA County supervisor, Baxter Ward finally garnered enough votes from his fellow supervisors to officially request that the Superior Court order a reexamination of the firearms evidence. On September 18, 1975, presiding judge Robert A. Wenke, W-E-N-K-E, complied. A 7-man panel of firearms experts was named. No sooner had the panel begun work than it was confronted with several baffling questions. For one, the LAPD unaccountably could not produce the laboratory records supporting its claim that in 1968 it test-fired 8 bullets from Saran's gun. For another, the gun's bore was heavily coated with lead, yet copper-jacketed bullets such as Saran allegedly fired leave a lead-free bore. The panel simply noted the leaded condition. 2 copper-jacketed bullets were fired to clean out the lead so the testing could go ahead, and did not speculate on how it happened. On Election Day, June 4th, by the way, I would interrupt here. This is the 17th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination, by the way. He was killed 17 years ago this evening. Continuing here, on Election Day, June 4th, Saran had practiced rapid shooting for about 7 hours on a San Gabriel range using unjacketed wad-cutter target bullets, which deposit lead in the bore. If this was the source of the extreme leading, he could not have fired copper-jacketed bullets of the type recovered from the victims and supposedly matched to his gun by Wolfer, for they would have cleaned out the lead. And Wolfer could not have test-fired bullets of that type to make the match, for they, too, would have had a cleaning effect.
It should just be mentioned real quickly that the man Wolfer that they're referring to is the police ballistics expert who was brought in to make the initial findings, and as we will see, or as we are seeing now, despite a great deal of inconsistencies, questions, and downright impossibilities, found in favor of the conclusion that Sirhan's gun had fired all the bullets.
And a man who was regarded as being of less than perfect integrity by a lot of his compatriots, a lot of his peers regarded him as being unreliable. But that's who this particular individual here is. A third mystery revolves around the Kennedy and Weisel bullets, Weisel being a witness in the pantry who was also wounded during the shooting. A third mystery revolved around the Kennedy and Weisel bullets. W-E-I-S-E-L is Weisel, by the way. After test-firing Saran's gun, the experts were startled to observe that the test bullets did not bear the microscopic indentations that appeared on the Kennedy and Weisel bullets, as well as on a bullet Wolfer had introduced at the trial of Saran as having been test-fired from Saran's gun. Nor did the indentations appear on photographs that Bill Harper took with the Balliscan camera for his 1971 comparisons. By the way, Bill Harper is a ballistics expert who worked with Turner and Christian on the case and came up with very different results than Dwayne Wolfer, the LAPD ballistics expert just mentioned. Repeating that last sentence. Nor did the indentations appear on photographs that Bill Harper took with his Balliscan camera for his 1971 comparisons. But they were visible on photographs taken for Baxter Ward's 1974 hearing. The indentations could have been made with any sharp object, including the tip of a pencil. They coincided on each bullet, so they could have been mistaken for matching marks. Whoever made them was obviously hoping to reinforce the single assassin position. The tampering must have been done sometime after Bill Harper's examination, which concluded that the bullets did not match. By the time Harper made public his findings and the second gun controversy erupted, the bullets were in the custody of the California Supreme Court in San Francisco. We learned from a clerk in the exhibit section of the Supreme Court that in July of 1971, about the time Joe Bush was announcing that he would look into the firearms discrepancies, a contingent from the DA's office, the LAPD, and Attorney General Younger's office visited the Supreme Court offices and spent several hours alone examining the Saran gun and the evidence bullets. So reviewing the information just related in this passage, a number of interesting things crop up in terms of the LAPD's handling of the bullets, the testing of the gun, and so forth. First of all, the laboratory record which would support the LAPD's claim of having test-fired Saran's gun was unavailable. Second, Lead deposits appear on the bore, which can't be accounted for considering that Saran was firing copper-jacketed bullets, and that in order to clean out the lead for a subsequent test firing of the gun, all the LAPD had to do was to fire two copper-jacketed rounds of the type Saran fired, and that cleaned the lead out of the bore. So the question is, if the LAPD had been firing the kind of bullets Saran had been firing, where did that lead come from? There was no record of the bullets out of the gun having been fired after that. Another little problem which crops up here is that wad cutters, at least to the best of my knowledge, are not made in .22 caliber. So, again, I don't know how that lead got there. I don't know where Turner and Christian are talking about the wad cutters, but to the best of my knowledge, wad cutters are not even made in .22 caliber. But at any rate, the lead cannot be accounted for according to the information the LAPD has presented. Another interesting thing is the fact that the bullets had markings at certain times and not at others, and there appears to have been a very timely visit between the time the bullets, between one of the examinations which did not reveal these characteristic markings and the time Bill Harper examined them and found that they were there. So apparently someone, again, recall the attempt to get Connor Noguchi to change his findings in the autopsy, someone has, even at this relatively early date and early stage of our examination of the Robert Kennedy assassination, is going to some length to try and support fallaciously the single assassin theory. And again, recall the position of Saran in the pantry and where the bullets came from.
Now, something also to try and put this in perspective, one needs to realize, or needs to think back and realize, that the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy was arguably the second most important murder in the United States in the last 50 years. I mean, you know, probably post-William McKinley. I mean, this was probably one of the major murder cases of our century. And as you will go through this with us tonight, you will see that the record of sort of spurious complexity on the part of the Los Angeles Police Department is balanced out and in fact overwhelmed by the at best completely cavalier treatment of evidence, of the testimony of witnesses, and that's the best possible way of interpreting it. As you will see, there's a lot of other ways to interpret it, including the outright destruction of evidence and obstruction of justice and badgering of witnesses and many other things. But so bear in mind, right away, we're already missing some crucial evidence, and some other evidence has been completely ignored, as was mentioned with the lead coating on the inside of the barrel. It just was overlooked by the panel of experts. I mean, one of the most obvious things that could just negate the entire validity of the ballistics test was just ignored. They just went right past it. This is a record that we've seen too many times in other assassinations, and we're going to see it again and again tonight. Okay. Now, about this time that the ballistics evidence was coming out, several people, including Allard Lowenstein, a former Kennedy staffer, a former congressional representative himself, was getting a little upset himself about some of the things going on. He felt himself that there was some kind of dirty business going on that needed to be looked into, and the cross-examining over the ballistic evidence was coming to court. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Allard Lowenstein later, because he himself met with a rather interesting fate. But what he did do was to contact Vincent Bugliosi, spelled, of course, B-U-G-L-I-O-S-I. Many of you are familiar with Bugliosi because of his involvement as the prosecutor in the Manson case. Bugliosi at that time was one of the best-known prosecutors in the country, probably still is. And he himself was a little reluctant to get involved because he was afraid he'd be seen as grandstanding. But as Lowenstein said, this is heavy-duty stuff. This is very important. This is the death of a presidential candidate. And, you know, there's weird stuff being done to the trial record, and we need you to get involved. So Bugliosi was brought in.
Interestingly, Bugliosi has been accused by many people of having covered up information in the Manson prosecution. There have been contentions that the Manson operation was, in essence, a sort of provocation. We'll go into that in a little bit greater length later in the broadcast. But Bugliosi has been accused of covering up information in the Manson case, so there are questions about his performance there. But in the Robert Kennedy case, he did sort of enlist with Turner and Christian here and played a leading role in their legal efforts to attempt to bring the Robert Kennedy case to justice. And one of the things that he did was to examine the L.A. County Supervisors Board of Ballistics Experts put together. And Niptuck's going to read you a summary and analysis of Bugliosi's cross-examination of them here in a minute.
Okay, again, reading from Turner and Christian. Because Bugliosi's cross-examination of the experts involved sophisticated and highly complicated firearms testimony, which consumed several hundred pages of court transcript, we must necessarily condense the points he established as follows. 1. Although 5 of the 7 experts testified under oath that it was their, quote, belief that 3 of the 7 bullets recovered from the victims, 1 from Robert F. Kennedy, came from Sirhan's gun, Not one of the experts was willing to make a positive identification. Positive ID, the authors put in parentheses, is very common in criminal trials. In a case of this magnitude, the lack of a positive identification is of monumental significance. Note, this testimony literally destroyed the LAPD's Dwayne Wilfer's grand jury and trial testimony that he was, quote, 100% sure that all 7 bullets positively came from Sirhan's gun, quote, to the exclusion of all other weapons in the world. And mentioning again parenthetically, it's just interesting again that Dwayne Wilfer is positive of this, despite the fact that Sirhan's gun apparently had not fired any of the bullets being used because of the lead jacketing on the inside of it, and a variety of other things, including marks that were missing. 2, all 7 experts testified that it was, quote, not their conclusion that there was no second gun involved at the assassination scene, which had been played by the press, that this ballistics commission had said one gun only. I'll read that again. All 7 experts testified that it was not their conclusion that there was no second gun involved at the assassination scene. Their testimony was merely that based on the exhibits they had been furnished, and the authors say they never saw some that they should have, they could find no evidence of a second gun. As Bugliosi would argue, quote, there's more than a semantic distinction involved here. In fact, there's all the difference in the world between no evidence of a second gun and a flat statement that there was no second gun. It would be like my walking down the street and saying I saw no avocados on the street. That doesn't mean there weren't any avocados, only that I didn't see any avocados. 3, 5 of the 7 experts recommended that further scientific tests, ballistics, spectrographics, etc., be conducted. As Bugliosi pointed out to the court, quote, as the court knows, there is a tremendous controversy in this case as to which bullet struck which victim and, based on the uncontested position of Sirhan at the assassination scene, whether it was physically possible for him to have fired all the recovered bullets. If any case ever cried out for a thorough, in-depth, independent ballistics examination, this case is it. A ballistics test, in parentheses, the authors say, attempts to determine the flight path of a bullet. A bullet follows from the moment it leaves the gun muzzle to its ultimate point of rest. 4. 5 out of the 7 experts testified that they did reach a positive conclusion that 3 of the victim bullets had been fired from the, quote, same gun, but they were not able to positively identify Sirhan's gun as being the weapon from which the subject bullets were fired. 5. The experts did acknowledge that there were some, quote, significant differences between the striations, meaning the lines, the markings, the indentations, on several of the victim's bullets and those on the bullets test-fired by the panel from Sirhan's gun. 6. All 7 experts testified that they were unable to determine the number of bullets fired at the assassination scene. 7. All 7 experts testified that they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. Which is actually the most important point of all, because the press had gone and said, panel says one gun. In reality, as Bugliosi pointed out, the panel said they hadn't seen evidence to support a second gun. But, as the point is made here, all 7 experts testified that they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. And again, they're getting some rather bizarre and tainted ballistics evidence to deal with, and a gun and a series of shells, slugs that have been apparently manipulated at some point, at least as far as the striations go. Here, fortunately, now memorialized in a courtroom under oath, were the true findings of the 7 experts, not the flat, quote, no second gun reportings of an ill-informed press. The previous written findings of these panelists, which had been misinterpreted by the news media, with the sole exception of CBS reporter Bill Stout, and which appeared to slam the door tight forever on further inquiry, had, due to Bugliosi's deft cross-examination, been reduced to their proper import and accurate legal dimensions. Unfortunately, however, Bugliosi's effort came 3 months too late to eradicate the impression that had been embossed in the public's mind by a mostly unthinking mass media.
So again, summing up here, an official ballistics panel of ballistics experts put together by the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors and denied the best evidence available in the situation still came up with the following conclusions according to Bugliosi. 5 of the 7 experts testified that it was their belief that 3 of the bullets came from Sirhan's gun. Not one of the 7 would make a positive identification, which is a very common thing to have occur in a case like this. All 7 experts testified that they did not conclude that there was no second gun, simply that they had no evidence of one based on the evidence that they had seen. 5 of the 7 experts recommended that further tests be conducted. 5 of the 7 experts said that 3 of the victim bullets did come from the same gun. Not one of them would identify Sirhan's gun as positively being the one from which it had come. The experts acknowledge that there were some significant differences between some of the markings on some of the different bullets. All seven experts testified that they were unable to determine the number of bullets fired at the assassination scene. All experts said they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. And this is the official finding on the case.
And remember, we're trying to make this cumulative. Remember, the first piece of important evidence that was introduced was the fact that the coroner himself basically said, although he didn't make the logical connection, I mean, he was not allowed to, but he said that his testimony basically said that Sir Han, as observed by many witnesses, could not have fired the fatal shots. They came from an inch to 3 inches behind Robert F. Kennedy, close enough to cause powder burns. Sir Han was not close enough. So we start to see the pattern of the willful distortion of evidence to try and fit into a pattern of a lone gunman, which, again, we have seen this before.
Okay, and remember that several of the bullets were acknowledged to have come from the same gun, but they could not identify Saran's gun. A little later in the broadcast, we're going to take a look at possibly whose gun that was and where it went. Okay, now continuing with Turner and Christian's narrative here, and some more results turned up by Bill Harper, a ballistics expert and criminologist who was working with them on the case, continuing with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. "Can't anyone on that panel count?" Bill Harper fumed. "They have just finished examining the 9th and 10th bullets and don't even know it." Unquote. Saran's revolver had held only 8 bullets. The 2 extra bullets that Harper was referring to in his phone calls to John Christian were labeled Court Exhibit 38 from the Saran trial. 2 expended slugs that the police had found on the front seat of Saran's old DeSoto sedan parked several blocks from the Ambassador Hotel. It had always been a source of curiosity as to why Saran would have retrieved the useless slugs and left them in his car. It was even doubtful that they had been fired from his gun since they were so mutilated from impact that they could not be compared with test bullets. Actually, the panel had discovered a clue as to the origins of the extra bullets. On their worksheets, they had noted wood in nose, unquote, and wood in nose and base, unquote. Wood from where? In the official LAPD ballistics report dated July 8, 1968, Dwayne Wolfer had stated that all 8 shots in Saran's revolver had been fired and all 8 bullets were accounted for. 7 had physically been recovered from the bodies of 6 of the victims, 2 from Senator Kennedy and 5 from the 5 victims who survived at nearby hospitals, and the 8th was lost somewhere in the ceiling interspace, unquote. In other words, the official LAPD position was that no bullets were found at the assassination scene, and other than an entry and exit hole in the ceiling caused by the lost bullet, there were no bullet holes on any of the doors or walls of the pantry. Therefore, if any bullet holes or bullets were observed in addition to those accounted for in the LAPD report, they would constitute almost unassailable evidence of a second gun having been fired, since no one claimed Saran fired more than 8 bullets. Yet there was evidence that more than 8 bullets had been fired in the pantry. Only hours after the shooting, the Associated Press disseminated a wire photo that was captioned, quote, "Bullet found near Kennedy shooting scene," unquote. See official LAPD photo. Well, that basically is a note about a photo in the photo section, which illustrates that here. It showed 2 LAPD officers inspecting an object embedded in a door jamb behind the embassy room stage from which Kennedy had spoken. The door was in a direct line from the pantry. The ceiling panels, pierced by the bullet entering the interspace, had been removed by the LAPD, booked into its property division as evidence, and later destroyed by the LAPD. On August 22, 1975, Deputy Chief Darrell Gates, I would add he's now Chief of Police in L.A., on August 22, 1975, Deputy Chief Darrell Gates advised during an interview on the NBC network, quote, "The ceiling panels were destroyed pursuant to the same destruction order that was issued for the destruction of the door jams June 27, 1969. The destruction was highly premature and completely improper, for Saran's attorneys had scarcely filed their appeal." So, basically, what we have here, again, is a destruction of evidence. It's the same kind of thing that we've seen before on the other assassination cases, but here, again, 8 shots came from Saran's gun. No one says there were more than 8 bullets. There are 2 bullets, which apparently came from Saran's gun, with wood in the base and nose, respectively, of the 2 bullets. No one knows how that arrived there. Apparently, material, some ceiling panels, as well as some other material we're going to examine here in a minute, was destroyed by the LAPD in a manner and at a time in which they had absolutely no business doing it. Saran's attorneys had barely filed an appeal, and key evidence in this case was destroyed by the LAPD. Recall that a lab report maintaining that they had tested Saran's gun was lost by them. There was was a curious visit by LAPD members to a place where evidence was stored, and that evidence changed in nature. Some markings then appeared on those bullets that had not been there. This is a pattern which is going to hold throughout the course of this investigation, and which NipTuck's going to tell you some more about.
Indeed. Continuing. One of the principal problems in attempting to reopen the investigation, although not an insurmountable one, was that the LAPD had engaged in almost wholesale destruction of the physical evidence in the case. In addition to the ceiling panels having been removed by the LAPD, booked into evidence, and destroyed, the center divider between the swinging doors and the door jamb on the left side received like treatment. This is not, they say in parentheses, the Rossi Wright door jamb, which is the door jamb just talked about with the apparent bullet hole and bullet fragment in it. The LAPD also destroyed the gun that they used for decibel sound tests in the Sandro Serrano affair, which is another part of the investigation that Christian and Turner will talk about later. Also curiously missing are the left sleeves on RFK's coat and shirt. Most suspicious of all, however, all important LAPD scientific reports, excuse me, in this case were, per the LAPD spokespeople, quote, either lost or destroyed. These included the spectrographic report on all the victim bullets. The purpose of a spectrographic test is to determine the metallic and chemical constituency of the recovered bullet. Boxes of ammo have code numbers which refer to the origin of the bullets therein. By furnishing this code number to the manufacturer of the bullets, they can ascertain the metallic and chemical constituency of the, quote, batch of lead from which the ammo came. If, for instance, a bullet recovered from a crime scene contains, among other elements, antimony, but a companion bullet from the same crime scene does not, a powerful inference can be drawn that the two bullets were not fired from the same gun. Since the LAPD contended that all 8 expended cartridges in the Sirhan gun came from the same box of ammo, which was discovered in the Sirhan car, the spectrographic report could have supported their scientific case. Conversely, however, it could also have refuted it. Now, just one last point to make on the spectrographic evidence. One of the main reasons the spectrographic evidence is so important in these kinds of cases, in these studies of the ballistics of a murder scene or a crime scene, is that unlike marking striations, whatever you want to call them, rifling, on bullets themselves, which can be physically added to a bullet or in some cases maybe even taken off of a bullet, a piece of lead, after the scene, after the crime, you would have to actually find a bullet fragment of the same chemical constituency to fake spectrographic evidence. So spectrographic evidence becomes very valuable when there's questions as to the validity of the physical observation evidence of where the, you know, if the slugs match. The spectrographic is all important. And here the LAPD, besides destroying door jams, door dividers, ceiling panels, all of which had quite possibly had bullet holes, and some that we know had bullet holes in them, they've also either, quote, lost or destroyed the spectrographic evidence.
Okay, now recall, of course, that the spectrographic evidence was destroyed in the John Kennedy assassination. Well, it basically was kept secret. It wasn't destroyed, but the spectrographic evidence was hidden from investigators in the John Kennedy investigation, and spectrographic or ballistics tests were not conducted in the case of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and yet despite Herbert McDonnell and other ballistics experts' testimony that they could have been. So obfuscation of the ballistics evidence and all of the other types of evidence is a pattern which almost becomes numbing after a certain period of time when you examine the assassinations.
I just wanted to mention that. As a matter of fact, in the John F. Kennedy case, once the spectrographic evidence was finally discovered many years after the fact, it proved to be quite a shocker, because although J. Edgar Hoover tried to gloss over what the spectrographic evidence had shown, saying basically there was only a slight differentiation between these two slugs or whatever, the fact is that in spectrographic evidence, any differentiation in the content of the bullets is a powerful argument that the bullets are in fact not from the same batch of lead, and hence not from the same package or not from the same group of cartridges. So in the Kennedy case, although many years after the fact, the spectrographic evidence proved to be another damning factor in the Warren Commission's theory, and it's very possible that some of the people involved in the Los Angeles Police Department cover-up, if there was such a cover-up, which you'll have to make your own mind up on later, it's quite possible they said, well, we're not going to be caught this way twice. We're just going to lose the spectrographic evidence.
Okay, and recall, if you would like to examine the course of the hiding in the spectrographic evidence and the legal machinations surrounding that. That was covered in our Guns of November broadcast, and interestingly enough, Judge John Sirica of Watergate fame was the judge who initially blocked disclosure of the evidence. And again, the Guns of November tapes are on file. If you don't have them, give us a call after the broadcast, and we'll tell you how to get them. Now, we're going to provide some information now which will indicate who may have fired the fatal shots from the rear of Robert Kennedy, continuing with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Donald Shulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, a CBS News employee who was behind Kennedy in the pantry and whose line of vision included both Saran and a uniformed security guard, told radio reporter Jeff Brandt moments after the shooting, quote, "A Caucasian gentleman stepped out and fired three times. The security guard hit Kennedy all three times. Mr. Kennedy slumped to the floor. They carried him away. The security guard fired back." Brandt said, "I heard about six or seven shots in succession. Is this the security guard firing back?" "Yes, the man who stepped out fired three times at Kennedy, hit him all three times, and then the security guard then fired back, hitting him." Shulman apparently thought that the guard fired at Saran, but accidentally hit Kennedy. So basically, we have one, a CBS News employee, basically has testified that a security guard stepped out, in the opinion of the CBS News employee, fired three shots at Saran, but accidentally hit Kennedy. So we're going to take a look at whether or not a security guard may have fired shots, and whether or not he hit Kennedy, and if he did, whether or not it was an accident.
When the second gun controversy showed no sign of dying, the authorities apparently felt they had to take steps not to get caught short. On July 14, 1971, investigators from the DA's office and Sergeants Phil Sartucci and Chuck Collins, formerly of Special Unit Senator, SUS, which was the special team set up to investigate the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. Let me start that sentence over. On July 14, 1971, investigators from the DA's office and Sergeants Phil Sartucci and Chuck Collins, formerly of SUS, secretly questioned a private security guard who had been at Kennedy's elbow when he was shot. The guard, Thane Eugene Caesar, although I've heard people pronounce it Cesar, and I'm not sure which, but Thane Eugene Caesar, spelled first name T-H-A-N-E, Thane Eugene, last name C-E-S-A-R, was employed on the day shift at the Lockheed Aircraft Plant in Burbank and was moonlighting for the Ace Guard service. The sallow-faced, black-haired security man was the only person in the crowded pantry other than Sirhan assumed to have drawn a gun, although witness Donald Shulman said he'd spotted two other revolvers, both of which he insisted had been fired. Caesar told the DA and LAPD investigators that when he saw Sirhan fire the first shot, quote, "I immediately ducked, and I immediately got knocked down," unquote. As he got up, he drew his gun. Quote, "Did you ever fire a shot?" he was asked. "No," he replied. Okay, bear that in mind. That's going to come up later. Thane Caesar, at Kennedy's right elbow, claims that when he saw Sirhan fire, he ducked and was knocked down immediately, that he never fired a shot. Okay. Caesar identified the gun he was carrying as a Rome 38 caliber revolver that he had purchased especially for his guard duties. Asked if he owned any other handguns, the recovered bullets were 22 caliber. He said that he had a 22 H&R pistol, but sold it to a friend at Lockheed who retired in February 1968 and moved to Arkansas. Okay, we'll go back to that. Caesar mentioned that he had told the police sergeant about this gun when he was interviewed after the assassination. In fact, he said, "I don't remember if I showed it to him, but I did mention that I had a gun similar to the one that was used that night," unquote. The investigators picked up on this contradiction in Caesar's earlier statement that he had sold the gun 3 months before the assassination. Their initial concern was whether he had told any outsider about it, and Caesar said he couldn't be sure. He then backtracked, saying he couldn't have shown it to the sergeant because he had already sold it. That seemed to satisfy the investigators, who told Caesar that it wouldn't be necessary for him to take a lie detector test. Okay, before I go on, let me just go back over this real quickly here. Another evidence of the relentless pursuit of the facts on the part of the Los Angeles Police Department and Special Unit Senator. Thane Eugene Caesar is the only other man presumed to have drawn a gun, okay, admits that he had a gun of the same caliber as the one that killed Kennedy and wounded five other people, claims that he sold it to a friend in February 1968 who retired, then claimed that he still managed to have it to show to a police investigator after the assassination, realized the contradiction, claimed he couldn't have shown it because he'd already sold it. And the men involved in this investigation of a very important political murder case say, oh, well, that's fine. Now we understand. Thane, thanks a lot. Don't bother to take a lie detector test. Going on with Christian and Turner's narrative. It didn't satisfy us, however. And on October 13, 1972, Christian, one of the authors, reached the man to whom Caesar had sold the .22 revolver, Jim Yoder, Y-O-D-E-R, who was living in Blue Mountain, Arkansas.